The United States is the world's current leader in incarcerations, with almost 2 million people serving time in U.S. jails and prisons. That's an increase of 500% over 40 years, according to the Sentencing Project, an NGO working to promote humane responses to crime. In recent years, voices calling for police and prison abolition have grown louder, making them an inexorable part of mainstream discourse on how to confront police brutality and racism in the U.S. criminal justice system. But the calls for abolition are not new.
Free Angela Davis! No more Kramer!
In 1970, political activist and university professor Angela Davis was jailed for 16 months, with the early part of her incarceration spent in solitary confinement. The case against Davis, who was once called a terrorist by former President Richard Nixon and listed by J. Edgar Hoover on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list for her radical politics, led to a global outcry calling for her freedom. 2 years later, she was acquitted of all charges and began a movement to abolish the prison industrial complex. But is abolition really possible? And what would take place instead of police and prisons? This week, an Upfront special with Angela Davis. Angela Davis, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront. The past couple of years have revealed to many Americans and much of the rest of the world what people of color have long known. The U.S. criminal legal system is racist, and attempts at incremental reform have failed. You and others have called for the abolition of police. Why?
Well, we've known for a very long time that structure of racism, it's such that it invades virtually all of the existing institutions in our society, and especially the penal institutions and law enforcement institutions. One cannot study the history of the police without also studying the history of racism. You know, I would say that since the aftermath of slavery, people have been aware of the role that the police play in producing and reproducing racism. I think that over the years, we focus largely on addressing specific cases, and we call for justice for specific individuals, and we call for specific police officers to be, quote, brought to justice. And in recent years, it's become clear that isn't going to solve the problem. And I want to point out the fact that the coming together of movements against racism in the U.S. And movements against the occupation of Palestine have begun to make it clear how the structures of racism insinuate themselves into police, into the very nature of policing, and especially recently through the militarization of policing. So in recent years, we've been looking at structural issues more so than the notion of bringing individuals to justice. Certainly the call to defund the police, which emerged in relation to the campaign against police racism unleashed by the police lynching of George Floyd, that movement began to make it clear that we need different forms of guaranteeing safety and security. So the call to defund the police was really actually a call to imagine new ways of guaranteeing the safety and security of our communities.
Some people have made arguments that gesture toward abolition, but don't maybe go all the way there. For example, some people have argued to disarm the police. Why is that insufficient in the minds of abolitionists?
Well, you know, I don't think we need to be so intransigent that we can't also embrace approaches that don't go nearly as far as we think they should. Now, I personally think that the call to disarm the police is a radical call. As a matter of fact, in connection with efforts to address the fact that there are more guns in this country than there are people, and the call to disarm the country also has to include a call to disarm the police. So I think that it's possible to frame that demand in a radical abolitionist way.
And would the same argument be made for defunding? Because, again, some people say defunding stops short. Do you see defunding as a stop on the way to abolition, or can it be something that prevents us from ultimately getting to an abolitionist world?
You know, there's no easy way to define abolition. And in my mind, abolition is a process. And I don't think that we can, at this point, say that we will have reached triumphant moment of abolition when 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 occurs. It is a process, and we learn on the way. And defund the police, of course, it's a shortcut. You know, all of these demands are shortcuts. We can't simply focus on isolated issues, isolated phenomena. We can't say defund the police, take all the funds away from the police, but leave everything else intact. The whole nature of that demand is to shift the resources into institutions that can really assist us in producing new modes of safety and security. So instead of giving the funding to this violent institution called the police, you know, fund mental health care, fund housing, fund education, fund free health care for everyone.
What do you see as some of the primary reasons why people oppose abolition? Right? I mean, there's, of course, there are the dyed-in-the-wool racists who just want to see police terrorism, right? There are those people. And there are people who might be uninformed about the issue. But there are also people who have a general sense of what abolitionists are asking for and still say, I don't buy this. I don't believe in it. 15% of Americans support abolishing the police. That means 85% don't. And the majority of black people believe that the police presence should remain the same. What are some of the reasons for that? Why are people still in this position?
Well, you know, first of all, Mark, let me say that the very fact that we can say that 15% of the population is in favor of abolition is kind of amazing, because for so long, abolitionist perspectives have been considered so marginalized that they did not even merit a discussion within the public sphere. And so as someone who has been thinking and talking and organizing around abolition since the 1970s, I would say since the Attica Rebellion in 1971, I'm actually surprised, and I continue to be surprised, that we are having this conversation now in the way that we are. I always thought, as I've said many times, that we were doing work that would allow generations in the future to have this conversation. You know, but of course, history doesn't unfold in that way. And the kind of confluence of events that occurred when George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were killed, and the recognition of the nature of racism as structural in connection with the COVID-19 pandemic, sort of fast-forwarded us to a point where we are now having serious conversations about abolition. So I'm excited that that many people are embracing abolition. Now, I do understand that most people are afraid of the new, of the unknown. And the police have always represented themselves as those who protect and serve. And so I think that particularly black people who have rarely have the opportunity to be protected and served by the police still, you know, want to feel safety and security. And the problem is that the police have kind of, in an ideological sense, have represented themselves as the only possibility of safety and security. So I think it's our job to begin to urge people to think differently about the very meaning of safety and security, and what would it mean to have real safety, real security? Now, what would it mean to have education available to everyone, free education? What would it mean to have healthcare? What would it mean not to have to call the police if someone who is in someone who has a psychiatric episode? What would it mean not to have to call the police, but rather to call a different kind of agency or institution where people are compassionate and understand of the nature of psychic difficulties, and would not approach the person with guns, but rather with the sense of rescuing them and assisting them to find some peace.
One of the things that I've encountered is that when I talk about abolition with people, one of the issues that comes up is that the people who are often most vulnerable to police violence and the people who are most likely abused by police are also the people most vulnerable to violent crime. And there's a concern that if police aren't there, and I live in a neighborhood where there's high amounts of crime and violence, that there might be either an intermediate period during abolition where I'm especially vulnerable, or a long-term period where I don't have faith that crime will be reduced absent a police presence. How do we go about thinking about deterring violent crimes? There's a psychiatric piece, there's that piece of it, but what about the violent crime that we see in community, the harm that's done? How do we think about deterring that?
Well, first of all, Mark, the developments that have led to explosive character of violence in our communities have taken a very long time. This situation has developed over years and decades, and I would say hundreds of years. And I don't think that there is one simple solution. The problem is that the police and the prison are constantly proposed as the immediate solutions for problems that require long-term examination and long-term strategies. We're looking at predicaments that evolve over time, since the aftermath of slavery. And if we think that there is one simple solution, or if we think we're going to get rid of these problems tomorrow, then we'll never get anywhere.
You talked about prison as well, and that's another key part of the abolition movement. And in fact, prior to a few years ago, I would argue, you know, the prison abolition conversation was actually much louder than the police abolition conversation. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about that. As of 2019, there were 2 million people in prison in the United States. That's a 500% increase over 40 years. That's the highest incarceration rate in the world. And although black people make up 13% of the U.S. population, we still account for 40% of the incarcerated population. How do we go about putting a dent in those kinds of stunning numbers?
Well, first of all, I think it might be important to recall that for many years and decades, it was very difficult to bring attention to the crisis within the prison system. As a matter of fact, I can remember in the 70s, we were talking about the numbers of people who were behind bars, and it was, you know, a few hundred thousand people, but that to us seemed to be a major crisis. But people weren't prepared to hear about it, because the nature of the institution itself requires a kind of clandestine operation, that it is hidden from view, and people are made to feel ashamed about having relatives behind bars. And so I think we tended to focus more on the prison system than on the police, because at least there were campaigns against police violence. I can remember in the 70s, we held hearings. I was working with an organization called the National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression, and we held hearings about racist police violence all over the country. So there was some attention, even though it wasn't the kind of attention that the issue has received in the last few years, especially since the emergence of Black Lives Matter, whereas very few people were even thinking about the vast numbers of people who were hidden away in these dungeons. But I would argue that the two issues have always gone hand in hand. Abolition requires a much broader understanding and a view that doesn't focus myopically on the particular issue, but one that calls for transformations throughout the society. And therefore, prison abolition involved police abolition as well. The prison abolition movement was so important and continues to be important because the underlying analysis links the racism in the criminal justice system and the vast numbers of people of color, not only Black people, but indigenous people probably have suffered to a greater extent, because indigenous people are per capita the largest population in relation to the population of indigenous people behind bars. So I think that what was critical about that movement is that it linked the vast numbers of people who were going to prison to the rise of global capitalism and to the breakdown of the welfare state. And so there was an anti-capitalist dimension present in the prison abolitionist movement that encouraged people to think more broadly, not only about the prison, but about all of the other related institutions, and about the structural racism inherent, and about the impact of global capitalism and the rise of prisons all over the world, not only in the developed world, but also in Africa and in Latin America.
I think the most asked question to the abolitionist is, and I think it's a fair question, is, but what about the people who pose an immediate threat to others? What do we do with the child molesters? What do we do with the rapists? What do we do with the serial killers? How do we, in the absence of the current prison, as we understand it, deal with people who pose an immediate threat to communities?
Well, it's so interesting, isn't it, Mark, that people always go to the worst possible example, and then use that as a justification for the treatment of millions of people who have not engaged in that kind of harmful activity. Now, no one is denying that there are serious acts of harm and violence that are produced by individuals who are a threat to others and to themselves. But if we simply argue that because there is this relatively small population of people, then we lock up more than 2 million people, to me that is illogical. That's the first point. The second point is that imprisonment reproduces those very problems. And so the violent individual who goes to prison is in a situation where she or he or they become even more violent as a result of the structural violence of the institution than they were when they went in. So in my opinion, and I think this is what most abolitionists would argue, it's necessary to pull back and ask larger questions, not only how we deal with this immediate issue, but rather how to deal with it in the long term. How can we understand and get rid of the conditions that produce such violence in individuals? You know, I think gender violence is probably a really good example for this larger problem, simply by imprisoning people who engage in gender violence has not had an impact at all on the incidence of gender violence in the world. It is still the most pandemic form of violence. So that, it seems to me, would signal that we have to figure out how to deal with the problem itself, rather than simply incarcerating people who commit the violence. How can we deal with the conditions that produce individuals that are primed to engage in these kinds of violent acts against women, against LGBTQ people, against trans people, all of the forms of violence that we would categorize under the term gender violence. So the larger question is, how do we address the ideology that encourages people to take out their frustrations and their fears by attacking others in that way?
And it seems that there is a very narrow idea of what restraint can look like, what separation can look like. The Quakers talked about, in that book, Instead of Prisons, they talked about this idea of restraint of the few, saying that there might be some people who need to be pulled out of society because they pose an immediate threat, but it seems that the challenge might also be that the only way we've imagined that is through caging, and that there might be other ways, whether it's mental health support, whether it's some other structure, that can allow someone who is a serial killer or someone who is a child molester to be pulled out of the space where they're doing harm without using the cage as the primary mechanism. But that requires a new kind of imagination. And it seems that there might be a crisis of imagination in the policy realm, in the academic realm, in the activist realm. So I'm going to ask you to help us imagine a little bit before we go. When you think about an affirmative vision of the world, not just what we don't want, police and prisons, but what we do want, what does that look like for Angela Davis? What does the abolitionist future look like?
Well, I've always linked abolition with socialism. So I would say that in imagining the future, it cannot be a capitalist future. It cannot be a future that is based on the exploitation of others. This future would be one in which the necessities of life are not commodified, in which one's capacity to live a fruitful life is not dependent on one's capacity to pay for those services. The point that I'm making is that we have to go further than these two discrete institutions, that we have to think about reorganizing our entire world. And I think that the danger of positing abolition as a narrow strategy that only addresses particular individuals is one that will prevent us from understanding that this is about revolution. This is about environmental justice. This is about workers' rights. This is a This is about eradicating gender violence. You know, this is about making education free for everyone. And so I could continue with that, you know, kind of imagining of the future. But I do think that the abolitionist imagination is central to the process of envisioning a new world and developing the strategies for challenging the current one.
Angela Davis, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
And thank you, Mark, for inviting me.
Everybody, that is our show. Upfront will be back next week.